Many thanks for downloading this podcast. This Sunday, my guests were the film composer Harry Gregson-Williams and Joanna Lumley. Well, I am really pleased to say that Joanna Lumley has come back again to be on the Culture Club. Thank you so much for coming back,
Joanna.
It's
so lovely to see you again, Charlotte.
Now, you are very much a Renaissance woman, I always think. You're an actress, a campaigner, an activist. And with your campaigning hat on, you're going to be hosting a charity fundraising event at the Cadogan Hall, aren't you? Which sounds wonderful, actually.
It's terribly exciting because it came the other way round. There's this remarkable man. He's Polish and he's come to this country, which he completely adores. All he wants to do is to do good in the world. Janusz Piotrowicz. And he, every year, gathers together what he's called l'Orchestre du Monde, the Orchestra of the World. And he gets the finest players from orchestras from all around the world in a kind of, I suppose you could call it a pickup band in the grandest possible way, to play two series of concerts for him. And the second concert he offered to me and said, I'd like you to choose a charity which will benefit entirely from this. So this being the year of the Gurkhas celebrating 200 years of service to the British Crown, and at the same time the ghastliness of the Nepal earthquake tragedy, we decided to combine the two, as it were, and to do the concert in aid of the Gurkha Welfare Trust, which looks after all the old retired Gurkhas and their communities within Nepal. So it's the most gorgeous combination. October the 20th. I'm hosting it. That's a grand way of saying that I get up on stage and grin at everybody madly and just look prouder than words.
And it's in a wonderful setting as well. The venue is the Cadogan Hall,
isn't it?
Which is, I think, a lovely venue.
I think it's ravishing. It's just the right size. It's got a huge sense of formality and informality. Mm. I love the fact that it's just on Sloane Square, practically, so you can get a bus or the tube and walk there immediately. And it's just right. It's got a lovely sort of human feeling to it. So it's grand, but not grand, you know?
Actually, that you've described it perfectly, exactly that. It's got a wonderful hybrid. Mm. It, as you say, it's neither too big nor too small. And there is an intimacy in there, I think. I pop in there for lunchtime concerts quite
a lot.
And I adore it. It's one of my favourite venues,
yes.
I think, now.
Yes.
Now, this concert features music by Beethoven, doesn't it? There's the Coriolan Overture and also the Violin Concerto.
Isn't that gorgeous? And the beautiful Alexandra Soum is playing the violin, who's... It's like silk. It's like silk in the wind and fabulousness. Beethoven has been a hero of mine literally almost before I could talk. So these are two great treats. And then the great Schubert's, you know, the great C major, which we're having as well. So this is a feast. And I think what I want to say, Charlotte, is that if you've never been to a concert before, this might be a perfect one to cut your teeth on, because it's, and I can't believe I'm using this word, it's really accessible music. It's not strange or odd or difficult or plangent or stringent or whatever the words you might use to say how awkward music is. This is heaven. This is music as good as it gets, played by the very best musicians in the world.
I couldn't agree more. And let's hope that it does raise an awful lot of money for what is a very worthwhile charity.
Wouldn't it be thrilling?
Will you be talking about the charity's work?
I am. I'm going to say how important it is that people understand that Nepal is still in desperate need of money. The size and the scale of the earthquake literally can't be, you can't even begin to imagine it, even in your wildest dreams. And so the work on trying to repair the country and the infrastructure and taking care of the people and rebuilding the houses is going to go on for years and years, if not decades. So we desperately still need money.
And people can get tickets via the Cadogan Hall website, I
Absolutely.
Assume.
Yes. Bing bong, it's in there.
Yes.
I type it out just out of pleasure in the morning and I look at it and go, look, it's still on.
And just give me the date again.
It's October the 20th. Well, do be there, because I'd love to see you.
I would love to be there, actually, Joanna. Thank you very much indeed.
That's
definitely one for the diary. Now, Classic FM have a Movie Music Hall of Fame poll at the moment. And Joanna, we've asked you about your favourite film music and you've come up with two, I think, fantastic choices. The first is Out of Africa. Why do you like that so much?
I think because at the time that the film was being made, I had a boyfriend who was in it, and I went out there. I went out to Kenya. I met Robert Redford and Streep, saw the gorgeous landscape. I'd been to Kenya before. And Michael Kitchen was the great actor who was playing in it. When the music came out as well, I thought it just captured everything. Heartbreaking, thrilling. Nobody writes music like John Barry. Nobody goes near that. It's just sensational. And it captures the scale of Africa. Yes. So it makes you weep a bit too. Something incredibly poignant.
Well, let's hear it now. The LSO was playing the theme from John Barry's Out of Africa, and the conductor was John Williams. Joanna, is the Ab Fab movie actually going to take place?
It absolutely is. And we start shooting on October the 12th. So it is real. It is absolutely real. We're shooting October and November. Then there'll be post-production, which means all the editing and cutting and music and stuff goes in. And the film will come out next year, probably towards the end of next year. And it's too much fun. We're all the same old gang.
Everybody's
there. Same gang, back. Absolutely. Oh, everybody's going to be there. And lots of extra people and quite a lot of people who've been in it in smaller parts.
Yes.
Going to be revisited, as we say.
You're going much fun. And is that going to be filmed in London or
abroad? Quite a lot of it on location in London. We're not using studios. We're going to be filming on location in London. And also, I think, in the south of France, which has rather cunningly been selected by Jennifer Saunders as somewhere rather gorgeous to go in the autumn.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that she's actually written the script, because she came on the show about a year or so ago and she was writing her book. And she was extremely funny in telling me about all her distracting techniques to actually not sit down and write. She loves sweeping, apparently.
She loves sweeping. She loves her grandchildren. Unbelievably, she's got two now.
Yes.
She loves outside. She loves gardening. Sometimes she just loves sitting down and staring at things. She likes flicking through magazines. Anything she can do not to have to hand in her prep, as it were.
And do you write, Joanna?
I don't write scripts, but I've done some books and things like this. I've done, I think, 6 books.
And does that give you enormous pleasure?
No, none at all. It's the most frightening and ghastly thing in the world, but God, you love having written.
Yes.
But sometimes when it is working, I love writing about real things. I'm not a novelist or anything, but I love writing about real events. And the times that I've travelled across Bhutan or been marooned on a desert island or things like that, those are thrilling to do because you're actually telling something that really and truly happened. I love reading reality books, as it were, and biographies of people and travel pieces and history books and so on. The odd good novel. I'd love to write a novel one day. Maybe I'll have a crack at it. Actually, I might start today.
I think you should.
You inspire me just seeing you, because there's nothing you can't turn your hand to,
I'm not sure that's true, but now you're a great traveller, aren't you? Can you tell me about some of the things that you've been doing in the last year?
This year, I've spent some time over in Tennessee, in Memphis, Tennessee, doing a film about Elvis Presley, another of my absolute all-time great heartthrob heroes. Elvis would have been 80 this year, which is hard to believe.
It is, isn't it? I always think of Elvis as timeless. It's astonishing to think he would be 80.
His voice is timeless. I think it hasn't sort of gone out of fashion ever. And because he died so tragically young, only aged 42, but it seemed a marvellous excuse to do a piece about how much I adore him, but follow his life through the Elvis who can be found through the friends, through his old places that he lived, maybe his early school, of course his wonderful wife Priscilla. And Charlotte, we had the most extraordinary thing. It coincided exactly with Sony casting, as I would say, the RPO, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, to record some of the backing tracks to Elvis' songs, some of the great songs. Mm. So they've kept Elvis, they've kept the choir singing, or the chorus, or whoever's singing with him. And Priscilla and I, it's lovely to be able to say that, Priscilla and I went to Abbey Road Studios and listened in on some of the recordings.
Oh, wonderful.
And she said how much he would have adored it. He adored huge orchestral sound. Very, very musical boy. So I'm hoping that somewhere on a cloud, Elvis, who's obviously waiting for me to die so that he can lead me through the pearly gate with his arms around.
Thank you, ma'am. Just taking care
of business. I can't tell you, honestly, the whole thing. Anyway, that little gorgeous film, which is only an hour-long tribute to Elvis, comes out in November.
And Joanna, that leads me on to your second choice of film music. Now, this really is iconic. It's The Third Man.
That zither music, it impressed me so much that when I went to my secondary school, I asked the nuns if I could learn the zither, and they just said, no. That's the end of that. But I think he'd been found. I always thought of the zither for some reason as a Greek instrument, which I'm probably wrong. But he was discovered in post-war Vienna playing the zither at a table. He was discovered. And they said, that's exactly the music for this phenomenally exciting film.
Oh, it's an astoundingly good film.
Orson Welles, never better. The story never darker or more convoluted, and true about this sort of black market in post post-apocalyptic, post-war yes. Vienna. Yes. Really thrilling, a thrilling piece. Each time you watch it, the time when the light strikes his face, the third man is standing in the doorway, and you haven't seen him for more than half the film.
That's right.
Oh, tremendous. Honestly. And this gorgeous, throbbing music. I couldn't love it more.
Joanna, as ever, this has been a huge pleasure, and you've left me with this wonderful image of you playing the zither, and I hope that next time you come on the programme, you will tell me how you've got on and that you are actually absolutely proficient in playing the zither.
Thank you so much for having me, Charlotte.
Pleasure.
Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM.
Well, I'm sitting at the famous Abbey Road Studios this afternoon talking to the film composer Harry Gregson-Williams, who's written the music for the new Ridley Scott science fiction film, The Martian. I know you're really busy, Harry, so thank you very much indeed for finding some time
to
talk to me. Can I start at the beginning? I know you were classically trained mm-hmm. as a child.
Yes.
I'm just fascinated by the transition from that background to becoming a film composer.
Well, yeah, it wasn't an instant one. I have to say that after I left music college, I was at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, and after that I actually turned to teaching for many years, mm. and which was my vocation, really. Probably still is underneath, so much so, actually, although I've been in L.A., you know, being a film composer for some 20 years now. About 3 years ago, I came back to England and went back to one of the schools that I was at as a boy, and went back to teaching for a year. I decided I had, you know, really need to get myself a bit grounded and back to basics, and that was really fun for me. So I see myself as a teacher who's been fortunate enough to become a film composer.
And how did that come about? Was it meeting certain people who encouraged you
yes.
to move into that world?
Yes. The redoubtable and inimitable Hans Zimmer was someone I met in 1994. He was loitering in London with intent, and he was just finishing The Lion King, which he went on to win an Oscar for. And he was doing this movie, Crimson Tide, and he had a bunch of really good music already written for it. He was recording at Abbey Road, which I thought was very impressive. and more than that, he wanted to shoehorn in some choral, some sort of large, tall, bearded, Russian-sounding men into, because it was a Russian sub-movie, you see.
Yes.
He didn't really, you know, didn't have any training as a choral thing, so he wasn't quite sure as to do that. And a mutual friend of ours, Richard Harvey, who I was working for, was a brilliant composer in his own right. Said that you'd be great. You should meet Hans. He's got exactly what you can give him on this movie, and indeed he gave me a very beautiful Russian translator, as I remember, a Russian choir, and Abbey Road Studio One.
Fabulous.
And so we became fast friends. And he basically, when he left, I was very miserable and thought, my God, I've missed a chance here. But the phone went, and he was like, you know, just leave that rusting tramp Spitfire where I last saw it in Lots Road, and you know, make your way to Heathrow. Get your backside over here. And in those days, you could get a one-way ticket.
Yes.
You know, pre-9/11.
Yes.
And no one really minded about my visa disqualifications. That was in 1995. So I've been there ever since, learning and trying to get better at it.
That's an incredible story. A lot of people, I think, are fascinated about the process of composing. Now, mm-hmm. you're working on The Martian. At what stage do you get involved in the production?
Well, in this particular film, it's probably typical of most films. Ridley called me just on the back of his previous film, Exodus, and said, look, man, I've got a brilliant script I'm going into production for. I really want you to do it. Mm-hmm. So he sent the script over. I read it. I loved it, and even if I hadn't, to be honest, it's Ridley calling. I think,
of course,
but it helps that I actually really loved it. And you know, he shot the movie. He's like him and his brother. I mean, I did many, many movies over 20 years with his brother Tony, who's sadly not with us anymore. And you know, I saw myself as a Scott brother composer. You know, and I've been so lucky to be involved with them both. And I got a bit of history with Ridley as well as Tone. Mm. You know, we did Kingdom of Heaven together, Life in a Day, a couple of things. And I wrote the theme for Prometheus. So yeah, he called me and said, I want you to do this. So after, you know, all the posh actors have been paid and gone home, and we can actually get on with making the film, you know, you enter post-production, and that's when a composer comes in. And you know, running concurrently to him trying to find his movie in the edit room. So he might have a movie that's 2.5 hours long. Mm. You know it's not going to be that long when it gets to theatres, but he hasn't decided quite what scenes he wants to lose, who he has to lose. He hasn't quite decided how to shuffle the pack, what order some of the scenes might come in. All that's happening at the same moment. He's trying to decide what the best music would be to come in. So that's when a composer starts, and it's trying to... They hit a target that's moving. That's what I want to say. Mm. People often ask me, well, why don't you wait until they've got a fine cut of the film? If I waited, I'd still be waiting, to be honest.
Oh,
they haven't fine cut it yet.
Yes.
And here I am on the final day of mixing the score. So, you know, one has to start. And it's a collaboration, very much a collaboration. Mm. And, you know, it's something that Hans taught me years ago. The way that it is that, someone is funding the movie, you know, and on this case, it might be hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't know the expense of this film, but you know, one's got to respect them. And then someone has a creative vision for this film, and that's the director, and he's the guy that we as composers have to aim at. And sometimes there are creative differences between what's, in this case, Fox or the studio, what they might want from their film or think they need in order for it to be successful, and what Ridley wants to give them. So that's between them, thank you, and I'll stay outside of that. However, music can play a really big part in that. You know, if Ridley's getting comments that we've tested the film in front of test audiences and the audience aren't liking the main character enough or something, or the film feels a little slow in the halfway point, you know, what can be changed at this point? Music can help you feel the pulses racing. The music can help with all those things. So, as I said, it's a real collaborative process. And, you know, I think the only other thing I might have liked to have done with my life would have been a sportsman or something. And had I done that and been any good at that, I wouldn't have been a golfer or a tennis player. I'd have definitely been a team player. You know, it would have been a rugby team or
That's
a cricket team.
Yeah.
And being a film composer is definitely being part of a team. You know, and I don't see myself as any different to the lighting guy, the costume designer, or, you know, the people who look after wardrobe. It's just, we're all part of a team trying to show Ridley things about his movie he doesn't know and hopefully bring something to the table, as well as bringing his vision.
It sounds to me quite pressured. You're writing to a deadline. You can't sit in your ivory tower and wait for the muse to strike you.
No.
How do you deal with those pressures?
I think that's part of being a film composer and part of something one has to sort of justify to oneself to begin with. And I think, again, you know, to be a jobbing film composer, you can't be someone who can't take notes.
Mm.
You know, got to be able to take notes because... Let's face it, most people have got an iPod or a phone full of music. Everybody's got an opinion about music. You know, not everybody's going to go to a movie and come out complaining about the hairdressing or the lighting.
True.
You know, but a lot of people are like, what's that music? Why was that music playing? Or wasn't that music fantastic? Or whatever. But we all sort of have opinions about that. And, because in this case, Fox is the studio and there are various producers there, and Ridley and his film editor has got also an opinion about how the music should be. It's fielding those opinions and knowing that perhaps sometimes, you know, what one instinctively feels is right is actually going to get pushed back and not be what's going to be in the film.
And what are you aiming for when you write the music? Is it to amplify the feelings of people watching?
Well, yes, but, you know, if one could say that, you know, say there's a scene that's very tense and, I'm sitting down to write the music one morning and, I could channel that and provide more tension. But, you know, music can also play juxtaposition to that. And you know, if one's going to bring something to a scene that's not already there, one's actually enriching the film in some way. So sometimes one is channeling what's there and amping up the feeling of what's there. Perhaps... It's a real necessity, you know. Perhaps this is a love story and there's just no chemistry between the actors and they've gone. There's nothing to be done about that.
So
music can actually play a huge part in I shan't say pulling the wool over the audience's eyes, but, you know, adding to the feeling of romance in the room. But, film music is often interesting when it's not doing that, when it's actually, you know, bringing a slightly different perspective to... or a different point of view to a certain scene, because then it really enriches and amplifies what's really going on. And in this case, you know, with The Martian, you know, we're talking about a guy who's stranded on Mars. He doesn't, you know, there's not a lot of dialogue in this film. There's plenty, but he hasn't got anybody to talk to up there, and the music does a lot of the talking for him.
So it's, in a way, the music is his internal monologue.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah, very much so. Things, you know, Ridley was really wanted me to find a way of filling some of the space So obviously we're up in space for a lot of this movie. And,
yes.
And it doesn't necessarily require too many notes, but needed a certain aura, a certain majesty, and a certain threat. And we found this gong, a nipple gong, actually, which we put in the middle of a huge gong in the middle of Abbey Road Studio One, and played very, very softly with gentle sticks, caused this kind of reverberation that hits you in your midriff. You're not quite sure what it is. It sounds almost alien, although yes, it's not electronic and it's not false. It's a real thing. He loved that. He loved that idea. And he jumped on that.
And you have a physical reaction.
Yes, you do.
A sort of visceral reaction.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yes. Harry, this has been great fun. Thank you very
good.
Much indeed
well, it's been
for
my
finding
pleasure.
The time to talk to me.
Not at all.
Thanks again for downloading the Culture Club podcast. I hope you'll join me at 3 this coming Sunday on Classic FM, when my guests include the actress Niamh Cusack.